Number 0730001, United States v. Sterling. Mr. Everly.
Good morning. Mr. Sterling was charged with three counts of possessing a firearm in furtherance of a drug trafficking crime and three counts of a drug trafficking crime, all related to three guns that were seized from him on three separate occasions by the police. The first was seized after the drug deal that had gone sour, for which he pleaded guilty. The second was taken some five weeks later, as he was walking down the street. 10 days later, the third gun was taken from underneath him on a couch that he was sleeping on in someone else's house. Now, during a police interrogation that's on videotape, Mr. Sterling tells the police that he got these guns, all three of them, from Wild Bill. Wild Bill is a drug addict who drives around in a van in Mr. Sterling's neighborhood looking for crack cocaine. According to Mr. Sterling, he said he went up to Wild Bill and said, "I need a gun." Wild Bill says, "Okay, give me some crack." Mr. Sterling gives him one or two pieces of crack. Wild Bill drives away. Later on, Mr. Sterling finds a gun that's been placed for him in the bottom of a trash can. That gun is taken away by the police, and he does the same thing, exact same thing with Wild Bill to get a replacement gun. That one is taken. He does it a third time. Well, in light of this description that he's given to the police, they charge him with the crimes that I mentioned at the beginning: possession and furtherance of a drug trafficking crime and drug trafficking crime, three times. This is on top of the other charges to which he's already pleaded guilty. These crimes, based solely on this confession, the convictions on these constitute 75 years of this teenager's 99-year sentence. Now, seeing what he's just done to himself, he later claims that Wild Bill is a fiction. He made him up. He did so in order to protect the persons who were really associated with these guns. That's what he testified to at trial. He named the two people from whom he bought the first two guns, and he identified the owner and actual possessor of the third gun, which he claims he never possessed in the first place. It was simply found in the couch on which he was sleeping. This situation, as Mr. Sterling argued below, implicates the rule that a defendant cannot be convicted based on an uncorroborated confession, especially one where the admission is made after the fact to an investigating officer, and the confession contains elements vital to the government's case. Now, there's no question that he made this confession to an ATF agent who was investigating the origins of these guns, and I don't think the government would disagree that these confessions contain elements vital to their case. In fact, we would contend that these confessions contain virtually all the vital elements needed for these charges.
Well, what standard would you say applies for corroborating evidence? What is the minimum in a case like this that the government would have to show in your mind?
The stated rule is that they have to present substantial, independent evidence, either that the crime was committed, or that the confession was trustworthy. And in this case, the district court identified three pieces of evidence that it believed satisfied the corroboration requirement. One was that he had the guns at all. And court does not explain how his possession of these guns when they were confiscated from him in any way corroborates his claim that he possessed them at an earlier time in furtherance of a drug trafficking crime, particularly when you don't even have a drug trafficking crime that is corroborated to any degree whatsoever. That he merely possessed the guns means nothing. If he had like a $20 bill in his pocket instead of the guns, and he said, "I got this $20 bill from robbing a liquor store. I don't think the government would argue that the mere existence of the $20 bill in his pocket is substantial independent evidence corroborating a liquor store robbery, particularly when you don't even have evidence that a liquor store has been robbed.
You mentioned there are three things. There's the three guns. What else did the district court rely on as corroborative evidence?
The second thing was that Mr. Sterling had been engaged in drug trafficking activity. He was known to have done so, number one, with the drug deal that went bad, which was the crime to which he pleaded guilty. The other was he was found one day by the police carrying 0.59 grams of cocaine. Now, this evidence was admitted under Rule 404B with a limiting instruction. But you know, if you take this evidence for its propensity value, I think it's really a stretch to say that this is independent, substantial evidence that he traded drugs for guns with a guy named Wild Bill, because this other crime's evidence doesn't involve trading guns for drugs, and it doesn't involve Wild Bill. The third and final.
And the transaction that he pleaded guilty to didn't involve drugs for guns.
No. It did involve a gun, but it wasn't a trade for
right.
guns. The third one involves, the third piece of evidence, in our opinion, is certainly the most interesting one. But not only does it fail to corroborate the existence of the crime, it actually corroborates Mr. Sterling's confession and just undermines the government's argument. And that is as the district court described it, evidence that there was a Caucasian male called Wild Bill in Sulphur, Louisiana, who owned a vehicle similar to that described by the defendant. Now, first of all, this is not an accurate description of the record. The district court is referring to testimony by a Sulphur police officer who said he was aware of a man named named William Elliott, who went by the name Wild Bill Elliott. He didn't, contrary to the district court's ruling, he never said what race Mr. Elliott was, nor did he mention anything about his car. Now, this evidence was presented apparently to make the jury believe that Wild Bill was a real person. But even accepting the evidence for that value doesn't take you anywhere. And by example, I give suppose Mr. Sterling had come up with the same story about trading crack for guns, only he, instead of saying he did it with Wild Bill, he did it with his brother. And I don't know if he has a brother, but assume that he does. I don't think the government or the court would say, well, the fact that this man really has a brother corroborates his claim that he traded crack for cocaine, for guns, with his brother. That's using the same logic. But the negative value of this evidence with respect to the strength of the government's argument is this. This confession was given to an ATF agent by videotape who, when you look at the videotape, you'll see he's very interested in finding this Wild Bill. After all, he's an ATF agent, and there's a guy who's stealing guns and distributing throughout the neighborhood. Now, the prosecution's going to have a strong interest in finding this Wild Bill. They're trying to pin 75 years on this defendant here who's recanted his confession. But look what they come up with. They got a police officer, a local police officer, says there's a guy named William Elliott in Sulphur. Now, how hard could it be to locate a William Elliott in the small town of Sulphur? And if they couldn't find him, they could go to the outpost, which is another aspect of this Sulphur police officer's testimony.
They probably could have looked him up in Facebook.
Well, I know that the officer testified that Outpost was a store that sells guns, among other things, in Westlake, Louisiana, and it's owned by Greg Elliott. Now,
how far are Westlake and Sulphur from where these events took place?
I don't know for sure. I believe Westlake is fairly close to Sulphur, maybe 12 miles, as I vaguely recall.
Yeah, but the underlying, this fellow, this defendant, where did he live, and where was his market area, so to speak?
It was not in Sulphur, but it was adjacent to Sulphur, on an, I believe on the other side from where Westlake is.
Okay.
But so the prosecutor does not ask, nor does this police officer say that while that William Elliott and Greg Elliott have any relationship to each other. But the reason why the U.S. attorney has this police officer even say this is to echo Mr. Sterling's claim that while Bill gets his guns from his father's gun store and that he steals them. So now you've got Greg Elliott in the outpost, which you can look up on the internet. It is there. So you go to there, you say, you confirm whether Greg Elliott owns it. Does he have a son? Is his name William? Does he have a nickname? What kind of car does he drive? Where can I find him? Have guns been stolen from your store? I mean, it would be unbelievable if the government did not do this. What is believable is that they just came up empty. And in this regard, and this isn't mentioned in the briefs, but Mr. Sterling was arrested because the first gun came back stolen, the one that was related to the bad drug deal. And it was apparently stolen several months prior to the time the police found it. Well, now they've got a stolen gun. Somebody's reported it stolen, so they know who's reported it. And if this gun had been stolen, now mind you, this is a gun that Mr. Sterling said he got only a couple of days before it was taken from him, from Wild Bill, who supposedly stole it from his father. Well, the police now have a stolen gun, and they don't come into court and say this gun was stolen from Greg Elliott or anybody that has any relationship to anybody named Wild Bill. And why is this? And the only reasonable answer is because they've come up with nothing. And why have they come up with nothing? Because Wild Bill, as Mr. Sterling says in his trial testimony, simply does not exist. And I think in the end, I don't think you will find another case where the conviction depends so much for all elements on a single confession that is so utterly uncorroborated. And for that reason, we believe that these convictions should be reversed.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Meng?
May it please the court, I'm Camille Jo Meng, and I represent the United States, who's the appellee in this case. Judge Southwick, I'd like to begin by addressing the question you asked counsel on what really is the standard for evaluating whether there's sufficient corroboration of a confession. And you know, I agree with defense counsel that, you know, one of the issues, at least, is whether the corroboration fortifies the truth of the confession. So we're not really talking about, you know, we've got three elements, how many are proved by the confession and how many are proved by independent evidence.
Was Mr. Sterling a felon?
He was not, Your Honor. He had he did have a criminal history. He had two juvenile priors, and he had, I believe, an adult misdemeanor, numerous probation violations, but he was not a felon.
But he was a pretty young man.
He was, Your Honor. And when you watch the video confession, one of the things he says is, I couldn't buy a gun legally because I'm underage. He was 19 at the time, 18 or 19 at the time that these events occurred, and he said, you know, that they asked him, well, you know, why were you buying these guns from Wild Bill? And he said, I couldn't buy a gun legally because I was underage. And he was correct about that. He was underage, and he was clearly aware of that fact. But so what we're talking about here is not, you know, we've got three elements. How many do we prove through the confession? How many do we prove independently? We're talking about, is there enough evidence in the trial record as a whole so that the jury's inference, the jury's belief, the jury obviously believed Mr. Sterling's videotaped and written confession and not his trial testimony. Is there enough evidence where we can say, yeah, you know, the jury could have rationally believed that that confession was correct. And I would suggest to you, one of the last things that Mr. Aberle said was, you won't find another case like this. And I suggest that that's true for another reason. There are a couple unique factors about this case. You know, I read a lot of confession cases writing this brief and preparing for this argument, and I can't find another one that's exactly like this in these ways. Number one, we have not just one confession, but two confessions. There was a written confession given when Mr. Sterling was originally arrested on this he wasn't actually arrested. It was after the drug deal went bad when he was questioned by police about the shooting of Mullins. He gives a written confession. And in that written confession, he mentions Wild Bill. So Wild Bill was not a recent figment of his imagination. In a written confession given about
Let's change the facts slightly. Let's say that he says his confession, I'm too young to buy a gun. Asked my brother who drives a red Mustang if he'd go do it for me and would he get me some guns. So I gave him the crack cocaine. My brother goes and gets me the gun and leaves it in the trash can. You can prove he's got a brother. You prove his brother drives a red Mustang. The defendant confessed to it twice. Is that enough?
Well, let me add the final really important thing, and that will make one of my other points and hopefully will answer this question. You also have a defendant who testifies at trial. And so the jury is able to evaluate what he claims is the real truth when he testifies at trial, in contrast to what he claimed was the truth when he testified on videotape. And that is a really, really unique distinguishing characteristic in this case. Mr. Sterling took the stand at trial, and he said, you know, all that stuff I said about Wild Bill, I was making it up. I was high on drugs. Here's the truth. I bought this gun from this one. I bought this gun from that one. He was cross-examined on that. You know, Mr. Sterling, why haven't you ever mentioned this before? Why didn't you ever tell us before that Wild Bill didn't exist? Okay. And the jury had the opportunity to look, because that's another distinguishing factor, that the second confession was videotaped. You know, I hear a lot of complaints, I read a lot of complaints about by defendants that their statements aren't videotaped. Well, this one was.
Well,
and the jury had the...
Let me ask you about that. What we're looking for is not the believability of the defendant. I mean, you probably have a very believable confession. The jury may well have very good reasons that on cross-examination of the defendant, they came to some belief about who's telling the truth and who's not. But there is this standard that we're trying to apply, which is where you started. There must be substantial independent evidence that the offense has actually been committed. And so we're not looking just at the defendant and his believability on the videotape and unbelievability on the stand. And it seems to me, I mean, just looking at this objectively and help me with it, what we have is very little evidence that the offenses to which he has confessed ever occurred. We know he had guns. By the time he confessed, he had already lost three of them, so his confession fits with that. He sold drugs. There are two pieces of evidence of that. But I see very little to go on, substantial independent evidence that he ever traded drugs for guns.
Well, I want to address first the legal standard. If you look at the Supreme Court's decision in Smith, 1954 decision, been cited numerous times by this court in its own decisions. The Supreme Court makes clear that corroboration is required, but that one of the means of corroborating a confession is to bolster the reliability, use extrinsic evidence, not necessarily to independently prove the elements, but to bolster the reliability of the confession itself, and therefore prove the offense through the confession. That's Smith. Supreme Court case 1954, been cited many times by this circuit, over and over again. And I would suggest to you that that's what happened in this case. And as you pointed out, we have the guns. Not only do we have the guns, but in his confession, Sterling accurately described the guns, that one of them had a wooden stock and was black. He was able to identify the Lorson by brand name and by caliber. The Brico, he correctly, you know, identified as having an obliterated serial number. number. So we've got the guns, and we have a description in the confession that matches the actual characteristics of the guns. One. Two, there's no question that he's a drug trafficker. He pleaded guilty to drug trafficking. He admitted under cross-examination that when that deal went bad with Mullins and Mullins was shot, he was selling him crack cocaine. There was the 404B evidence that that showed he was a drug trafficker. I mean, that wasn't seriously contested at trial. He tried to minimize by saying, I use more than I sell, but that wasn't seriously contested. There's also another thing that this court in Abogando and in another case called Gresham said you can also look at the detail in the confession. The defendants argued that some of these facts are non-predictive. Well, you know, you look at Gresham and Abogando, and some of those facts were non-predictive, too. You've got Wild Bill. That's a very unusual name. This very detailed description of his vehicle. It's a camper that's kind of like a Winnebago. It has a brown stripe and a spare tire. And Wild Bill lives in Sulphur, which, by the way, is like a small suburb of a not very big town called Lake Charles. So we're not talking about metropolitan Houston here. This is a.
And we're not talking about much of a difficulty for the prosecutor to have followed up and found Wild Bill.
There was some effort. I don't know how hard it would have been, Your Honor. I do know that there is record evidence that there is a person who goes by the name of either Wild Bill or Wild Bill Elliott, that he lives in Sulphur. Again, it's a small town, that he has an arrest record. And on cross-examination, it was asked, well, does he have an arrest record for stealing guns? Well, no, not that I know of, but he does have an arrest record. On your question, Judge, about Westlake versus Sulphur, I think if you look at volume 3 of the trial record, page 126 to 127, is where the officer testifies about Sulphur versus Westlake. I believe his testimony is that Greg Elliott, who owns the gun store, and the gun store is definitely in Westlake, but that Greg Elliott is either from Sulphur or Westlake. And, of course, you know, the jury is entitled to give that whatever weight it wants to give it.
Again, I don't know where prosecutors are in the world of computer-assisted research, but you can look up those people instantaneously and find a great deal about them, especially if he sells guns, because he's going to have to file other forms.
And I don't disagree with you, Judge. You know, could the prosecution have done more? Maybe. But the question is not how much more evidence could we find. The question is,
go to Greg Elliott and ask him, you had any guns stolen? Do you have a son? Has your son taken guns from you?
It's not
minimal effort.
I'll tell you, Judge, I agree. It's not this. There's no, Greg Elliott didn't testify. There's no further evidence about Greg Elliott, except he does own a store where guns are sold. Bill, Wild Bill's last name, there was a Wild Bill named Elliott, that's what it is. And now there's also some other, the confession is not just about the guns. The confession is also about the drug trafficking. And there was also corroboration about some of these individuals that Mr. Sterling was involved in drug trafficking with. For example, this guy Michael Lyons.
One cannot escape the impression that the government is totally piling on a young drug addict. I mean, there are probably any number of drug prosecutions that we see up here where every darn one of them possessed guns, and you probably could have shown that they possessed a gun every time they, you know, had a gun in his pocket every time he sold crack, which is essentially what we have here, except that all you're going on is the confession, and you didn't bother to make the rest of the case.
I would distinguish this case, which does involve multiple 924C charges, and admittedly a great deal of statutory exposure.
5 years of stacked.
I don't disagree with you, Judge, but this is a case. I mean, I would make a distinction between a defendant who sells crack to an undercover officer on 3 successive days with the same gun on the coffee table from a case like Mr. Sterling, who does business this way. I mean, according to his confession, the way he does business, he says, I have to have a gun because I don't want people robbing me and stealing my crack. i.e. what happened with Mullins. I don't want that to happen. I have to have a gun. I can't buy one legally. So every time he needs a gun, he goes to this Wild Bill guy. He knows Wild Bill is, he calls him a crack fiend. Not my name, his name. He says he's a crack fiend. He needs the crack.
Produce so one person, one buyer from him, he says, yeah, he always had a gun when I bought crack from him.
How do you not know it's a crazy dad who says, I can't help this kid, he's beyond repair, but at least I don't want him to get killed, so...
We don't, Your Honor, but I guess my point is, I think your question was...
Your best point is that he testified and the jury was entitled
yes,
to decide.
Yes.
But the Supreme, and certainly that's possible, but, I mean, the Supreme Court did say you have to have some kind of corroboration. And in that case, they did, in fact, have net worth statements, so they had documentary corroboration.
What I would ask the court, you know, one of the cases I cite in my brief is this Crawford case. It's the only case I found in my review where a where we were addressing a sufficiency of a corroboration, sufficiency of the evidence, and in which the defendant testified. And Crawford is a little unusual because the way Crawford framed his corroboration argument was sort of an admissibility, that the confession isn't admissible unless it's sufficiently corroborated. And this court, you know, correctly said, no, it's not an admissibility problem. That's a sufficiency of the evidence problem. And then it went on to discuss the sufficiency of the evidence. And one of the points it addressed was that Mr. Crawford had argued, well, you know, there's no evidence of a certain point other than the defendant's statements, and he explained those away when he testified at trial. And this court said yes, but the jury was free to, you know, disregard his explanations regarding his prior admissions of criminal conduct.
Well, that's true of an uncorroborated confession.
That's
but
right,
but you need corroboration.
And I would suggest to you, we do when you look at the entire record evidence, and if the standard is there enough evidence for us to believe that Sterling is not making this up, that he's not sitting there coming up out of the clear blue with Wild Bill and two rocks and trash can. I mean, this was an extremely detailed statement. The recreation center, the Mossville Recreation Center under a trash can in the back. White camper, brown stripe, spare tire, 1:30 to 4:30 in the afternoon. Evergreen Road, Prater Road, Sam Houston Road.
That's just all in his confession. It was detailed.
Very
and you
detailed.
Didn't back up a single piece of it.
I wouldn't say that we didn't back up a single piece of it, Your Honor. There is some, there's corroboration, like I said, and the jury could give it whatever weight it wanted. The defense counsel was free to argue, well, why didn't you bring Wild Bill? Why didn't you find Greg Elliott? And as I said, there's also corroboration on the drug trafficking part of it. There's, you know, Michael Lyons and another dealer named Rollo, and the transcript it appears as Roll-Up, but, you know, that could, you know, again, the jury was able to say Rollo, Rollo, Roll-Up, you know, whatever. But I guess what I'm saying is if you have to watch the video confession, which the jury had the opportunity to do. And the jury had the opportunity to look at his demeanor.
So your position is a videotape confession does not need corroboration?
No, that's not my position at all. I'm saying that when you look at the fact that you've got two confessions that are consistent in significant respects, that's one factor. Two, a video confession where the jury can look at the defendant's demeanor. Remember, his explanation in his trial testimony was, I was making it up because I was high on drugs. Well, the jury has the opportunity to watch him on video and to see, does he look like he's high on drugs? You know, how did he answer the questions? Did he have the same thing that we ask trial juries to do when people testify live? And so all I'm saying is, because it's a videotape confession, the jury had an opportunity to evaluate what, you know, his credibility then as opposed to his credibility on the stand, because he told two completely different stories.
Let me ask you, to what offense, Sterling pled guilty to some counts, and that was the drug transaction. What were the counts involving Mullins?
He pled guilty to one distribution of crack cocaine charge. That was a B1A quantity. It was a significant quantity.
So your answer, what I really want to make sure is the proper premise, Isn't that a clear violation of what we're trying to corroborate, but, which, you know, wasn't charged that way? He used a gun in that transaction involving drugs. You don't have to worry about what we're fighting about here. And that got pled out at whatever way that it was pled and whatever sentence was imposed. And we have this, I don't want to prejudge. I mean, not prejudge. I've been looking at it a good while. But at least there's a serious issue here about whether you've proven this. Why couldn't you have proven it there? Wasn't that there?
The way that this case was charged, the drug and they were pair transactions. So the count three was the distribution of crack cocaine on that day. And that was it doesn't have Mr. Mullen's name in it, but that's what it was. And then there was a 924C that he pled to that was paired to that because during this drug deal that goes bad, Sterling has this firearm and they're fighting over it and the firearm discharges. So the conduct he pled guilty to was that distribution at the same time he possessed the RG that was discharged. And that was the conduct to which he pled.
Well, but you seem to me you had the facts to go a different direction with that, which would have gotten the prosecution to where it wants to be. I guess that's an observation. It's really not a question for you. But it seems to me that this is a difficult way to try to make this case.
Let me ask you if he had just pled guilty and you dropped the other counts, gun counts, he's pleading guilty to the distribution and the gun count on Mullins. Couldn't the judge have looked at the confessional evidence as a way of within the guidelines on those events? Of course he could have. They're relevant.
Yes. I'm trying to figure out
But you wouldn't get to stack 75 years on.
Well, the sentence would not be the same. There could be other drug conduct taken into account that might have increased his guidelines.
I just cannot imagine. I mean, we sentence Mexican drug dealers, kingpins, to these kinds of terms of imprisonment. I can't imagine a 20-year-old who couldn't even shoot straight. There's something fundamentally wrong with what's happened here. That's my opinion. I speak for myself alone. And, of course, you have to make the arguments you have to make. Mr. Aberle. And the law is the law, Mr. Aberle. So,
just countering the government's argument, which they seem to rely on most, is that this confession was bolstered in its veracity or credibility. Contrary to that position, unlike a lot of cases you'll find, Mr. Sterling had a motive. This is what you'll find in his testimony. He had a real plausible motive for lying. He's protecting real people by making up a fictitious person. Number two, the confessions. The government talks about two confessions as being indicative of, reliability. But these two confessions are not the same in one very critical way. In the first confession, when he is... after the first gun is taken from him, he says he got the gun from Wild Bill for $20. That takes away the crime.
Let me ask, are there other opposing counsel talk about the believability of it on the videotape? Are there any that's the dispute here. Are there any clear errors, falsehoods in what he does say to the extent you're saying he made up this. Are there other things that he says in his confession that are not supportable by the evidence?
Not supportable as opposed to contrary to the
evidence? I don't know what else.
I don't think we've proven anything he said was false.
Okay.
That's
all I'm asking.
I mean, the biggest point I think you have is you've got the failure to corroborate when everything about that, this particular aspect of the case, says there should be corroboration. There should be some evidence, better than what they came up with, that there really is this guy, Wild Bill, who drives around that neighborhood in that particular van. Thank you.
Well, wait, come back. I don't see much case law cited in your brief here, so what's your best case for requiring a reversal here?
Well, Smith?
Pardon?
Smith? Reynolds? The ones I recall offhand.
Well, you didn't cite many, so I just wondered. Okay. All right. Thank you. Court will be in recess.